The first topic is presented by Laura Weyburn, Thani Sutner, Michael Cohen from Discovery Actuaries, and they'll be talking about the opportunities around alternative reimbursement mechanisms or models, given the HPCSA rule changes, the recent ones, I think the end of last year. So over to Laura and team.
Hello. Hi, everyone. Good morning. We're here today to talk about the recent changes to the HPCSA ethical regulations in the context of what this means for alternative reimbursement models. We'll cover a quick background of the healthcare environment, what we mean by ARMs, which will probably be a bit of a refresher for all of you, and linking this to contracting on value, which is an important theme. Next, we'll go into the detail of the actual amendments to the ethical rules and what this means practically. We're then going to look at multidisciplinary teams as a particular focus area for this presentation, and we brought in several international case studies. And lastly, we'll spend some time discussing what opportunities and risks we as actuaries should be thinking about in the context of the rule changes. The healthcare landscape we work in is complex, with many factors contributing to the overall environment. Nevertheless, opportunities for innovation continue to be important. On the outer part of the circle, you can see external factors or macroeconomic trends such as high interest rates, longevity, electricity challenges, unfortunately, geopolitical uncertainties, and NHR, as we will discuss later. Within the inner circle, we understand that funders face contribution pressure, members face affordability challenges, and we've got a challenging competitive landscape with multiple products. And within all of this, an aging population and increased disease burden. We need to find ways to ensure that we navigate this complex environment in the best way, and one way is through innovative ARMs. Firstly, what is meant by ARMs? So ARMs mean alternative reimbursement models, where there are alternative forms of payments from the traditional fee-for-service billing. With these different ARMs, there comes different levels of risk sharing. We have included common types of ARMs, where moving along the y-axis is an increase of risk transferred from the funder to the provider. ARMs range from fee-for-service, per diems, fixed fees, and global fees, which are more common in the hospital setting, which we're going to unpack. Also episode payments, partial capitation, and full capitation. ARMs should be underpinned by risk, shared risk and savings, quality and performance incentives, and can take the form of prospective and retrospective contracting. In theory, risk transfer helps to align incentives of the two negotiating parties, facilitating positive outcomes for both parties as well as for the patient. If properly aligned, alternative payment methods can generate positive results for practitioners, funders, and patients, but if imbalance, could be unsustainable for either one of the three. The devil in the ARM contracts is certainly in the detail. Fee-for-service, so we're going to discuss this in a bit of detail, and fee-for-service is a predominant reimbursement structure in South Africa where healthcare providers are paid for each service rendered. The HMI did note that the South African fee-for-service usage is a lot higher than around the world. The financial risk of cost increases under fee-for-service is borne by the funder. Costs related to service, volume, length of stay, technology used, or consumables are all billed to the funder, be that the insurer or the patient. The system is straightforward, with industry standard fees established upfront through tariffs. Reimbursement levels depend on the specific benefits covered by the insurer, ranging from 100% to other multiples of the agreed tariff. Insurers often negotiate these rates to create networks or preferred providers. Fee-for-service is simple and transparent from a funder's point of view. The system provides detailed data, helping funders understand cost and utilization trends, and especially from a funder perspective, we rarely place a lot of detail or emphasis on this data to be able to price and manage utilization effectively. and doctors in the fee-for-service environment are free to practice without constraints from alternative reimbursement models, allowing them to treat patients as they see fit. Fee-for-service is also useful in driving productivity. But on the other hand, there are disadvantages of fee-for-service, and that the big risk comes in overservicing, where providers may perform services to increase their income. The system incentivizes activity rather than outcomes, potentially leading to escalating costs. And while there is some form of collaboration within the fee-for-service system, the current structure of siloed practice billing separately doesn't inherently drive collaboration. There's also a significant burden of billing and coding for providers, and a similar burden for funders to review and adjudicate these claims. So in summary, while fee-for-service offers simplicity, transparency, and provider autonomy, it also poses risks of overservicing, escalating costs, and admin burdens. Addressing these challenges requires careful consideration of ARM models that prioritize quality and efficiency. Next, we're going to discuss bundled payments, specifically fixed fees and global fees. And global fees is going to be a specific focus of this presentation in light of the HPCSA regulation changes, which Michael will take us through later. So fixed fees and global fees are very common in the hospital setting and are usually made for types of costs or procedures that have relatively low variation. Fixed fees are often used to cover just the hospital portion of the payment or of the event, whereas global fees usually take into consideration other providers such as hospitals, professionals, can also include allies such as physios, depending on how we structure the global fee. So in the global fee, you're transferring intensity and severity risk, but no risk of utilization. So you're actually not preventing the admission from occurring in the first place, but only managing the cost of the admission once it occurs. Advantages of this reimbursement method is that they are simpler to administer because you just have to bill the one fixed fee. But on the other hand, the underlying data is lost. And for the funder, there's cost predictability and income predictability for the provider. And also, global fees drive coordination of care, which is a key theme of the HMI and ethical rule changes. But on the other hand, the disadvantages come when transferring the risk of underservicing, which could lead to poor quality outcomes, such as readmissions, where providers may discharge patients sooner than they need to be because they're already getting a fixed fee for that admission, regardless of how much services are rendered within it. And also, just having a fixed fee or global fee in place without quality measurements could mean that there could be adverse outcomes that we didn't foresee when pricing. Another point raised by the HMI was the issue of carve-outs, which are typically come through variation and clinical appropriateness that almost causes that admission to not fall in the global fee or fixed fee reimbursement. And it's very important to monitor the level of carve-outs and ensure that there is appropriate risk transfer once we've taken these carve-outs into account. As we've mentioned a lot, in order to track the global fee and the risk transfer, it's very important to maintain that fee-for-service data. And that is something that you have to almost make sure when structuring a global fee. One of the ways to do that is to almost do a retrospective global fee where you still get the fee-for-service data and then after a certain amount of time, reconcile that fee-for-service data with the set fixed fee. And another consideration to take into account with the global fee is it's actually difficult to assess who bears the risk. So for example, if something went wrong, who do you hold accountable? Is it the hospital? Is it the professional? And these are all things that we need to take into account. Next, we're going to discuss capitation. So capitation arrangements are primarily used for primary care. And under capitation agreements, funders pay providers a fixed fee per beneficiary for a specified number of beneficiaries enrolled in a particular medical scheme or health plan in advance. The fixed fee covers a defined set of services provided for a specified duration and a specified number of beneficiaries whether or not they seek the care during the agreed period. Providers then take responsibility for all the contracted medical needs of each beneficiary. This can take the form of a half capitation or full capitation. Global capitation models are sometimes used in the mining sector, where workers are geographically isolated. So what will happen is there'll be a doctor or nurse-led team to attend to the entire workforce's health and are reimbursed by way of a single payment calculated on a per capita basis, irrespective of the hours worked or the number of consults. The advantage of capitation is that there's a fair bit of risk transferred, but it allows for the funder to be able to assess the costs and have that are predictable, and for the provider to have a steady stream of income. It also allows them to have considerably reduced admin responsibilities. But one of the major disadvantages is that there could also be underservicing, where the provider underservices the patients allocated to them. And also for the doctor, they may find that they are undercompensated relative to the actual workload. So for example, the population allocated to them might have a higher disease burden, forcing doctors to work long hours and to see patients, all patients with appointments, leading to queues and waiting times because they pay to manage that patient that is allocated to them. And then, as we keep saying throughout, you may also lose that granular data to allow you to monitor and reprice going forward. Also underpinning capitation is you assume that the provider has the means and infrastructure to take on all these additional risks that we've mentioned. So now we want to just speak briefly about contracting on value. So what we've mentioned now is we've mentioned price, which can be assessed through ARMs. But what the HMR really pushes to, and internationally what has been pushed, is the move towards value-based care. And value-based care consists of both price and quantity. And ideally, what we want is for there to be effective use of costs, but ensuring that quality is maintained. And there's a very fine balance. So we've gone through a few of the ARMs, which reduce the cost, and we've also spoken through the different advantages and disadvantages. But what is really important is to make sure that we have quality outcomes to measure. And in order to assess this quality, we have to work together with clinicians to come up with effective quality metrics and ensure that the payment structure that we have is doing what we intended to.
So, in summary, the use of ARMs in the current environment is limited. Even more limited is where value-based care is a component of the arrangement. And looking at the health market inquiry findings, we see that there is a push towards the use of ARMs more broadly. The HMI explicitly encourages the adoption of effective ARMs across stakeholders to encourage better value for money and healthcare provision, speaking to value-based care, which we've just highlighted. The findings suggest that previous regulations may have hindered the adoption of innovative payment models, as suggested by the HMI, because of restrictions on multidisciplinary practices and on global fees. So we'll step through in the specific amendments to the regulations in some detail to understand what they mean and how the environment may respond. For some context, the regulations pertaining to the HBCSA ethical rules of conduct were first published in 2006. More recently, in 2019, in its comprehensive review of the healthcare environment, the health market inquiry made findings and recommendations about how the market could be moved forward in a more efficient manner. In 2022, amendments to the regulations were proposed. In 2023, proposed amendments were published and were gazetted in December of 2023. So these developments are very recent, and it remains to be seen how they will be adopted in the market. The key points that the HMI raised, which were incorporated into the amendments to the regulations, were the need to shift focus away from fee-for-service reimbursement towards meaningful risk-sharing and contracting on value-based metrics, as we've highlighted. to create outcomes measurements in the industry, again, speaking to how quality of care is emphasized, not just the cost of care, and to encourage the effective use of ARMs with real risk sharing and a commitment to providing better value for money. So the HMI stance is a value-based care approach with ARMs as a key lever to enable this enhancement of value and quality of care in the environment. The HMI was, however, not prescriptive on the structure of ARMs, which gives stakeholders some scope to innovate. So, how were the regulations amended? Broadly, the amendments allow for multidisciplinary teams and the employment of healthcare practitioners, with the aim of encouraging more collaboration in the treatment of patients to improve efficiency and outcomes. There were 5 rules or sub-rules impacted by the amendments to the regulation. Rule 7 on fees and commission relates to how healthcare providers are allowed to be reimbursed. Rules 8 and 8A relate to the structure of practices. Rule 18 relates to professional appointments and the employment of healthcare professionals. And Rule 23A relates to the financial interest of healthcare professionals in hospitals and their reporting requirements, which is beyond today's focus. A common thread across Rules 7, 8, and 18 are the following terms which are important to discuss or note up front. First of all, multidisciplinary healthcare or teams refers to healthcare provision involving practitioners from different registration categories who work as a team to provide holistic and coordinated care to the benefit of the patient. Appropriate healthcare is healthcare delivery where the expected clinical benefits outweigh the expected negative effects to the extent that a treatment is justified. Quality healthcare services refers to the delivery of care that's effective, safe, patient-centered, and aimed at achieving the best and most desirable outcomes using evidence-based approaches. While collaborative practices are practices where healthcare practitioners across different professional backgrounds work with patients, their families, and caregivers to deliver the highest quality of care across settings. Looking at the different rule amendments in turn, starting with Rule 7, previously the regulation only permitted practitioners to receive fees for services personally rendered. In the context of ARM innovation, this could be interpreted as to restrict ARMs in which payments are received by a single party to reimburse several other practitioners, for example, in a global fee arrangement. The amendments have been changed to allow for the sharing of fees between providers, extending how they collaborate and consequently how they may bill for services. Such sharing of fees is conditional on a structured agreement between practitioners or on practitioners working together in multidisciplinary teams where high-quality healthcare services are provided in a cost-efficient manner and enhance access to appropriate healthcare. Some risks in such fee-sharing arrangements relate to wasted care, inappropriate levels of care provided, or conflicts of interest among team members. The HMI noted these risks and that the HBCSA should retain its monitoring function over potential ethical issues. Before the amendments to the regulation, Rule 8 stipulated that practitioners were only allowed to form practices with practitioners from the same registration category. There were some exceptions. Radiologists were allowed to form practices with nuclear medicine physicians and radiographers, and pathologists were allowed to form practices with medical technologists because the professions are related to each other in terms of the nature of the way care is delivered. The HMI recommended that Rule 8 should be relaxed, but acknowledged that practitioners should remain their professional autonomy and independence to safeguard the interests of patients. And as such, the rule was amended to allow practitioners to work with other practitioners from different registration categories. This would be conditional on there being an agreement between them, arrangement or model in place, which ensures high quality of care services or products to patients, structures to contain costs, and enhanced access to appropriate healthcare. Looking at Rule 8A, previously, this rule did not allow practitioners to share their rooms with practitioners from other registration categories, and in conjunction with Rule 8, seriously inhibited the formation of multidisciplinary teams and practices. The amendments to Rule 8 allows practically for the formation of multidisciplinary teams, I guess under the same roof, and removes the obstacles for the formation of multidisciplinary teams. Now to the rules concerning professional appointments. Previously, the employment of practitioners by persons not registered in terms of the Act was not permitted, unless special exemption was granted by the HPCSA. In addition, the HPCSA's policy on business practices did not permit the employment of healthcare practitioners by private hospital groups. The HMI didn't take a strong stance either way on the issue of employment, and proposed that the HPCSA should set conditions for and monitor the employment of healthcare practitioners in order to ensure that the interests of patients are prioritized over potential profit incentives. The HMI recommended that the HPCSA should provide clear guidelines to ensure that professional appointments do not result in increased costs, over-servicing, or the loss of clinical independence on the part of clinicians. So the amendments to Rule 18 allows a practitioner to accept appointment or employment on condition that the employment contract has as its primary aims the enhancement of the quality of healthcare services in a cost-efficient manner, the enhancement of access to appropriate high-quality healthcare services, and is designed in such a way to not extract profit to the detriment of patients. While the rule change to Rule 18 may be welcome in the context of delivering coordinated care in multidisciplinary settings and attractive to various stakeholders, there are still some practical challenges. For example, in relation to the regulations of the Medical Schemes Act, no provision is made for the issuing of practice code numbers to non-registered entities who lawfully employ registered practitioners. So how then are registered practitioners to invoice medical schemes for the clinical services they render in terms of such employment? And the answer to this is unclear and will perhaps precipitate much needed changes or needed changes in the manner in which practice code numbers are issued. So to summarize, these amendments include wording that aim to promote the provision of higher quality, more efficient care to patients by improving coordination between healthcare providers who should operate in multidisciplinary teams. To make the operation of multidisciplinary teams a little bit more concrete in light of the enhancements to the regulations, excuse the pun, we've shown an example of the different providers in a surgical setting an episode and how they could form multidisciplinary teams with the aim of providing high quality care to patients through their coordination. If we had to think about a surgical admission, there are many practitioners and stakeholders involved throughout the patient journey. A surgeon performs the operation where an anaesthetist is required. Potentially a physician is called, consulted pre or post-op. Prosthetics may be required, for example, knee replacements or valve replacement in cardiac setting. Physios are needed in the rehab process. The episode or part thereof occurs at a hospital, in theater, or in the wards, and the patient probably requires medication for pain or other clinical reasons. So coordinating this process through multidisciplinary teams has the potential to unlock clinical and financial value. From a clinical perspective, the coordination of practitioners in multidisciplinary teams may improve patient outcomes through collaboration to optimize care in a way that reduces complications and enhances recovery. And for example, providing pre and post-operative education to the patient. There could be better opportunities for effective communication and coordinated efforts within teams to prevent errors and improve outcomes. And there could be more of an emphasis on peer review and monitoring, which could be promoted within multidisciplinary teams. Multidisciplinary teams may also lead to better patient-reported outcomes because teams could tailor individualized care plans to the patient, which positively impacts their experience as well as treatment adherence. And through effective communication with the team and with the patient, they could facilitate this. There are also opportunities for innovative ARMs under the amended regulation, which reimburse multidisciplinary teams and can incentivize and reward commitment to the highest standards of care, as well as aligning financial incentives between the funder and the team. We've gathered three case studies which show ARMs for multidisciplinary teams in different markets and clinical contexts. And through this, we hope to give a taste of how ARMs may develop locally in the future under the amended regulations. Firstly, looking at total joint arthroplasty, the study looked at bundled payments for care improvement initiative by Medicare in the United States, which started in 2013. This served as a way to move away from the fee-for-service reimbursement with all the drawbacks we noted earlier on in the presentation. And under this initiative, organizations entered payment arrangements that included financial and performance accountability for episodes of care. A mix of prospective and retrospective bundled payment models were tested, and these bundled payments attempted to align incentives for providers, so hospitals, the physicians, surgeons, acute care providers, and encourage them to work closely across specialties and across settings. These initiatives were found to have led to a transition from a system which rewarded providers for volumes of services to a system rooted in value that places heightened emphasis on quality of patient care. The results from these studies showed that bundled payment models did show to reduce costs, largely through lower length of stay in hospital, as well as decreasing readmission rates, and reducing the number of patients sent to inpatient rehab facilities. Quality of care, as measured by complication rates and patient satisfaction scores, have also shown improvements. The primary care environment served as another example where quality of care improvements and cost efficiencies could be seen from coordinated care facilitated by an innovative reimbursement arrangement. In the Dutch healthcare system, GPs are gatekeepers to specialist services. They coordinate the provision of chronic services and may substitute in some cases for hospital services as well. Therefore, the GP decisions can be seen as partly responsible for all the downstream healthcare costs that patients in their care incur. When considering a value-based contracting design, the investigators from a Dutch insurer noted that a powerful value-based incentive was one that encourages GPs to understand the value implications of their referral policy and decisions on the substitution of services which they could provide, for which the financial risk lay with the insurer. Therefore, a method of value-based contracting was tested in the Netherlands, in which GPs were allowed to share in the savings in the total healthcare expenditures relating to their patients, conditionally on achieving some set quality outcomes. The contracts aim to incentivize GPs to become critical gatekeepers, coordinate the provision of care better, and substitute for specialist services where appropriate. And the findings of this initiative showed that participating GPs saw reductions in healthcare expenditure for their patients of about 2% relative to comparator non-participating GPs. Savings were mainly realized through lowering the volume of specialist care. And interestingly, almost every participating GP displayed at least some cost-saving behavior. But beyond the cost efficiencies, the implications of these findings suggest that shared savings arrangements effectively transmitted value-based incentives to GPs, resulting in cost efficiencies without compromising patient satisfaction levels. In addition, even a one-sided arrangement where GPs do not share in excess spending on the downside resulted in efforts to reduce spending. And finally, contrary to expectations, the shared savings incentives led to a drop in the GP's own expenditures, which indicated that fee-for-service incentives may not always be stronger than shared savings incentives. Finally, looking into the maternity space, we've seen improvements in outcomes where care has been provided by multidisciplinary teams, facilitated by a reimbursement arrangement. A global fee for certain maternity and obstetrics codes was introduced by Blue Cross Blue Shield in Vermont, which covers a range of antepartum, delivery, and postpartum services, including consults, admissions to hospital, the delivery itself, certain drugs required, as well as follow-up visits for mother and child. This was on condition that the care would be provided by the same physician group or healthcare professional group throughout the episode. The potential effectiveness of this may be seen in the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Center for Maternity Care in Vermont, which achieved higher quality care compared to other facilities. On average, this facility saw 26% lower episiotomy rates and 17% lower C-section birth rates, which indicate healthier outcomes for mothers and babies. In the private healthcare environment in South Africa, given the high C-section levels and rates, the effectiveness of multidisciplinary teams and global fees for maternity may be an area of exploration. And under the amended regulations, there may be solutions for higher costs of professional indemnity insurance for providers in this sector.
So now we'll be talking about actuarial considerations for both funders and providers in how we might price or design ARMs, as well as how funders and providers might work together to determine the financial sustainability and quality of care delivered under these arrangements. We'll specifically talk through a journey of actuarial considerations, but I think equally this could be depicted as an actuarial control cycle, which is continuous in how it's applied. First up, very importantly, as you would have heard, we've got focus on data and systems. Both are required for the funder and provider to capture data, particularly at the most granular level, to enable pricing, to enable monitoring, as well as to enable the evaluation of risk. The more granular the data, the better. So often that is a key consideration when setting up an ARM, which we'll talk to, as well as subsequently. Under a global fee arrangement, the point about which providers are included is very important in the sense of who's taking on the risks, who are the contracting parties, and how might costs and risks be shared among the parties. In particular, in a global fee, the arrangement could differ between one party being responsible versus multiple parties, and ultimately who decides how those payments are divided and where the risk resides. And that is a crucial part of the design process. The next step we're suggesting is understanding very carefully the population covered. What are the criteria for inclusion in that eligible population, be it demographic and clinical factors, as well as which services are provided to which segments of the population and what those services comprise. So there would be work to be done to understand the population risk factors, and that brings us to the next point about risk adjustment. Risk adjustment is a critical component to take account of variation in the underlying population so that costs can be understood relative to the population presented. So one would need to assess those criteria for inclusion of various risk factors, both at a demographic and a clinical level, as well as in the context of the levels of care that are provided within a reimbursement structure. Next, looking at risk mitigation measures. So how does one build the contract and design various features to allow for the areas of risk that are either deliberately or unintentionally taken on? Khani alluded to carve-outs, which are an important part of assessing the extent of outliers or potentially high-cost cases and the variation within the population. Contracts may differ to the extent that carve-outs are either wanted more of or less of, and it's important to assess to what extent the carve-outs are actually part of the risk share, and specifically what one's wanting to share risk on, or rather if the carve-outs are there really to get to a more stable and homogeneous population group. Censoring is part of that work to understand variation and also high-cost claims and where to apply that. So in doing many of these risk mitigation measures, it's important to use statistical modelling to understand the extent of variation in designing risk-sharing corridors, as well as understanding the impact of that variation. Depending on the reimbursement structure, the impact of utilization is important, both within an event or for the events themselves. So in a global fee, it would typically be on the event itself, so one would need to also bring in utilization within the event, while if you're looking at a capitation fee, it's obviously important to consider utilization across the board. The key theme that we've spoken about today is also quality, so understanding and assessing, usually together with providers, which quality indicators we want to incorporate, and do these indicators fairly reflect the clinical practice as well as have a bearing on outcomes. If we look at the Donabedian framework for quality, which looks at structure, process, and outcomes, we've spoken more about outcomes, but one could design these quality metrics taking those various factors into account. The next step, and importantly related to the quality indicators, is understanding and agreeing on how those quality metrics are rewarded. And in order to do that, one does need very granular underlying data to measure quality and how it's changing over time. This takes us then into the payment structure, which is an important consideration to enable many of the things we've spoken about. For example, is it a real or virtual reimbursement? And this speaks to elements of prospective or retrospective contracting. And what's important here is that one should be deliberate about the data retention at the start of a contract, how that's managed and preserved throughout the process by both parties. Equally important in the payment structure is understanding upside and downside risk, how that's shared between the parties, and how each party might contribute to that. And it's easily determined, or more easily determined, through the fee-for-service equivalent billing data, where you have that. Taking the next step in reporting should cover various factors, and this is part of the governance process. Very importantly, to look at how experience is progressing, evaluating savings, both from a cost perspective as well as the quality outcomes, and how the performance of the contracts are in respect of the risk share, any upsides, downsides, achievement or improvement. And getting a good understanding of where the efficiencies are coming from, as well as where quality improvements are coming from. Next, and this is quite important for us as actuaries, is to think about where these arrangements might be valuable in designing new products and taking into account the impact on pricing, where a more efficient and cost-effective contract is available. And then lastly, but again, continuously, is governance, where things like documentation and reporting are needed, but also a clear understanding of risk transferred, and as a provider, risk taken on. So providers would require this kind of infrastructure in order to effectively manage ARMs and value-based care contracts. Ultimately, given that this is a new development in the environment, we're excited to see how it unfolds and how the industry moves forward. In sharing thoughts today, we want to share the message that we're ultimately striving for win-win outcomes within this paradigm. For the patient, it's about improving healthcare quality, outcomes, and their patient experience, as well as improving affordability, which directly links to access. Secondly, for healthcare practitioners and providers, looking at sustaining their volumes, enhancing their earnings opportunities where appropriate, and enabling providers to practice at the appropriate levels. And then for funders, continuously looking for more efficient use of funds, designing fair reimbursement models that reflect quality of care, not just cost, and again, supporting the development of affordable products. So together, this means working smarter and together, as opposed to necessarily just working harder. So in conclusion, the messages that we want to share with you and leave you with are firstly that the HPCSA speaks directly to ARMs and value-based contracting, in the current environment, fee-for-service is our predominant way of reimbursing. We do have ARMs in pockets, but these are largely focused on cost containment. To contract effectively, we believe that, and as per the HMI recommendations, contracting should take into account both cost and quality measures. The HBCSA ethical rule amendments are a step in enabling more risk sharing, particularly in a bundled manner, as we've pointed out, and enabling also further quality inclusion. And this allows providers to be salaried and promote multidisciplinary teams, which then further could enable more use of these type of payment methods. We showed several case studies that have been proven to be successful internationally, specifically multiple joint replacements, which are directly related to an aging population. Primary care setting, which continues to be a focus in our environment as to how to improve and strengthen primary care. And then maternity is a key example. And lastly, just to leave you with those thoughts around the actuarial considerations, we believe that actuaries can play a critical role in designing ARMs to support, promote, and really reflect the value potentially in multidisciplinary teams, taking into account key considerations on data, design, risk sharing, and monitoring, and ultimately, as I said, to achieve a win-win-win outcome. Thank you.
Laura to manage her team, who's going to answer, and then I'll rove around if there's any questions. Sarah. Gail? Sarah, yeah.
Hi there, it's Sarah Bennett from MedScheme. Thank you for an interesting discussion. Just a question on the structure of the multidisciplinary teams and the reimbursement models. And this is in the context of palliative care and based on a personal experience where there is a multidisciplinary WhatsApp group for a particular patient and many providers on that WhatsApp group, but only a few providers end up delivering care to the patient. So I guess the question is, are we comfortable with reimbursing providers who are not actually delivering care? So they will, you know, there will be some who involved in care and some in the team who are not involved in care, and are we comfortable with that? Thanks.
All right. All right. Hi, Sarah. Thanks for your question. So I think this is where we wanted to stress the importance of data retention so that we can understand what's actually happening when initially pricing the ARM and also then when subsequently reviewing it. And I think what happens with many of these ARMs is the data gets lost, so you don't really have a good sense of who's providing what and where the risk is taken and where the service is ultimately being delivered. So I think that's a key enabler potentially of understanding the value delivered. And I guess that's where potentially these multidisciplinary teams require more structure and management as to who's responsible for delivering care. And so when contracting on these arrangements, getting tighter and tighter as to where the care is actually being delivered. I think it will take some time for these models to evolve and mature, but it's ultimately got to be fair for all the parties involved, whether it's the funder or the provider. So I guess in a fee-for-service environment, the market will, in a sense, work itself out, but the patient often has to do that, while in this setting, the providers have to find a way of working it out.
Hi guys, it's Matt Zylstra, also from Discovery. Great presentation, I think. Just one question, I don't know if you touched on it, around possible capital requirements for some of these provider groups, in the sense if they're taking downside risk, that could mean quite a payback to some of the funders. And you know, just some thoughts on capital requirements and the role of actuaries actually supporting the providers and providing services to those providers to make sure that they've got adequate capital reserves.
Hi, Matt. Thank you for your question. I think that is a very important consideration. I think as it currently stands, even managed care organizations don't really have specific capital requirements to report on. So this might be something that needs to be thought about, and potentially actuaries can provide those required capital for the different providers. I think also one piece that is quite important is if we say look at the hospital space that may be able to employ doctors now, they actually may have more capital available than providers might. So having a multidisciplinary team where some of the providers actually have higher capital or more capital to provide to that team might actually enable better servicing and enable all the providers to work together and actually meet the capital required for the entire episode. Does that help?
Thank you. Good morning, all. I'm Carl from Momentum Metropolitan. Thanks for the presentation. Just perhaps food for thought, and perhaps we should, as a profession, reframe some of the discussions around transfer advantages and disadvantages, particularly the capturing of data. I think in one of the slides you said the advantage of one model versus the other is the data, and but that, you know, the disadvantage comes with the administration burden. But if you think about it, the data is always important. And perhaps we should just reframe to say that, you know, the data is always important, but perhaps the importance shift to different stakeholders within the value chain. Particularly if you now have the data, you set up the contract, now all of a lot of the data or detail disappears, and 3 years later you want to reprice, but now the data isn't available. It might happen that there's a transfer of data, so now the funder doesn't have the detail, but perhaps then on the provider side they have the systems to capture the data, to monitor their own efficiency, etc. But that then causes a different format of data, so that the data is actually lying around all over, depending on the provider, which would make repricing and standardization more difficult. A second point, in one of the slides you referred to, as part of the contracting, there would be a component of censoring, which is a loaded term. It would be interesting to lean into that a bit and discuss what that would actually entail. I think there would be rules of engagement that would be critical. It sort of gravitates to the counterproductivity that comes through similar with the carve-outs within these contracts. So just interesting. Thanks.
Yeah, I appreciate that those interesting set of remarks. I think on the first point relating to the potential additional administrative burden that comes through sort of bundled payment arrangements where initially the admin burden is relieved, but then on repricing another administrative burden is created. I think that's certainly a point that resonates and could be incorporated here.
Thanks. One more.
Yeah, so that is correct to say that, you know, when you censor a particular event from a contract, you know, the costs associated with the event that aren't included may be material. So, you know, they're definitely considerations in how outliers are managed in across contracts that need to be taken into account in various ways, be it truncation or censoring or incorporating them fully, but it just needs to be appreciated the level of the censoring or the level of the trim with respect to how much data would be excluded or events excluded or admissions excluded from the contract. So yeah, all important factors to balance for all stakeholders when designing contracts and reimbursement arrangements.
Hi, I'm Sarika from Discovery. Thanks, guys. That was a great presentation. Just more of a remark. I think the success of these models will depend on how we can incentivize and encourage the practitioners to participate in these types of models. And we know that there's a lot of mistrust in the industry, both, you know, if you look, you've got the funders, then the hospital groups, and then the practitioners. So we need to build on those relationships. And I think also just making the model simple for the doctors or the practitioners to understand and not to feel intimidated, because they wouldn't have the resources that we have, you know, to fully understand the risks and the different types of models. So we may have to have different types of models, you know, depending on who exactly you're targeting, whether you're targeting a hospital group or you're contracting with a small group of providers. But thanks, I think there's, yeah, maybe when we meet again in a few years' time, then we can feedback on some of these models that have been developed.
Thanks. I think I'd like to wrap up. We just passed time, so I think that's good. Maybe as I'm the chair, I can, or the MC, I can make one quick comment. The one aspect that comes in is we talk about risk and risk transfer, but often it's financial risk and whether or not the doctor will be underpaid. Yeah, so I think there's another, at the provider level, another risk, which is the medico-legal risk. And you talk about accountability or responsibility or who's providing the treatment. So from the provider's side, they often overlook, or they require the medico-legal considerations. You know, if it's a midwife, obs and gyne kind of multidisciplinary team, and when does it hand over, and if there is a civil case from the patient against the doctor or the midwife, you know, where's the accountability? So I think that's another thing that needs to sort of be considered there. They have risks in the medico-legal space, unfortunately, in the private sector. So just a comment. And then a last question just makes me think, and some comments we've been looking at our side, is that more and more it feels like the provider side, and I suppose we're talking practitioners, not the bigger supplier of providers, but almost need to be a joint CEO, medical and business, yeah, or finance. Yeah. So it almost feels like more and more they have to get a bit bigger, they have to become multidisciplinary and need the business acumen, not just the medical. Would you agree?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it for individual GPs with such fragmentation, I think they probably carry quite a bit of the burden of administrative business considerations. In a model where employment's permitted, some GPs may be relieved of that burden in some cases, while others may be even more burdened by it. And I guess internationally, there is that balance at play where NHS, for example, practices are subcontracted by the NHS, and that a single practice owner, be it a doctor or a business person, has to carry that burden, whereas the doctors working in the practice may not be under that strain. But yeah, I think definitely a consideration for individuals.
Thanks. And you mentioned NHS. That's a nice segue into the next topic, which is NHI. So thank you very much. Give them a hand.